This is Mae Brussel. This is part two of broadcast number 717, September the 2nd, 1985. The downing of that airplane sounds shocking, that they would send it into territory where the Russians would be forced to shoot it down. But there's been a lot of discrepancies about the airplane not being on that course at all, and that there was, in fact, a bomb in the plane that was set off that blew it off at a different place, and that the Soviet Union had evidently blown away one of the K-135s, the spy planes, and the other plane, the passenger plane, had been blown up at a particular place, and the shock was charging the Soviet Union with blowing down the passenger plane. The silence, as I say, of not thinking that Larry McDonald could be a target to protect all these other heavies on his organization is totally crazy. As a matter of fact, there was an article apropos of that spy dust in the Soviet Union that from the Los Angeles Police Department, and the LAPD said, well, we've used this kind of powder all along to track people, and we put it, it's not dangerous, and we've used it. But you remember at the time of Watergate when G. Gordon Liddy was going to put powder on the steering wheel of Jack Anderson to kill him, and it would go into his bloodstream, and it was a powder that he couldn't see but would get into his fingers. And he talked about that. We have used this, the CIA, for a long time. And also when Liddy got out of jail in 1980, he told how he was going to kill E. Howard Hunt and how he planned to kill him because he had testified before certain committees. There's no mention of the relationship of that to Dorothy Hunt. And remember, I wrote an article on 30 primary witnesses of Watergate that were murdered. But he talks openly about the ones he almost killed or wanted to kill, or put LSD into the soup of Daniel Ellsberg, but he has the anxiety to kill and the technology. But Liddy works with these people, and he works with John Singlaub, who set up Soldier of Fortune. Liddy's picture was in there in the 10th anniversary issue. They sell full-page posters of Liddy, and he talks about, I'm going to kill this person and that person, and John Singlaub is on the board of Western Goals. And Liddy is talking about murders that he wanted to do. He's going to kill Jeb Magruder at one time. He thought he had an order to murder him. So what's so hard about unloading a man whose organization has been tied into these scandals in L.A. for months, and it's going to go ready to go to court, and finally the LAPD settled out of court rather than have all this material to go out? Now, Larry McDonald's group, headed by the man that went down in that Korean airline, hired Jay Paul, who was in correspondence with another group, and that was Franklin Camper. Remember, I did a broadcast, this was in 1984, April 84, tape number 646, on the fact that Jay Paul and Larry McDonald from Western Goals had information in secret files that they were sharing with the men from Crystal River, and those were the men that were arrested at Crystal River, Florida, and I had linked them possibly to Alexander Haig and the Reagan shooting. Well, the LAPD was messed with Frank Camper, who now makes the front page of the Wall Street Journal and tells how he's going to cut off, how he cuts off ears and how cut people's throats. And he trained the Sikhs that haven't been found, that were going to kill Rajiv Gandhi in the United States, that have been linked to two people that were blown up in Japan at the airport. And if the luggage had gotten on a plane, it might have killed everyone on the plane. See, they do have bombs that go out on planes. And in case you wonder about Franklin Camper's training with the Sikhs, they went up to Canada, and then Air India went down, and it hasn't been ruled out that that wasn't an explosion or a bomb either. So Dorothy Hunt goes down on a bomb, and Air India kills goodness knows what passengers were on there. There's large numbers of passengers recently, and they had plans and training in this country to blow up atomic plants, and they were linked to the murder of Rajiv Gandhi's friend in the parliament, who I mentioned last week, and then the peacemaker there, the Sikh peacemaker, was murdered. I mentioned him last week. Well, they were trained by Camper, and Camper works with Jay Paul of the Los Angeles Police Department, and they all work with G. Gordon Liddy and go to conventions with G. Gordon Liddy and Gordon Novell and Robert Brown of Soldier of Fortune and John Singlaub of Western Goals. So what's so unusual about unloading a congressman for a lot of good reasons if his organization is going to expose all those heavies? And besides that, Franklin Camper's group, as I said before, goes back to Texas Governor John Conley, who's on the board of Permandex, Centro Comercial Mondiale, and written up in by Paris Lamont in the Kennedy Conspiracy and also in the Torbett document. So around the organization of Larry McDonald, coming from Atlanta, Georgia, and I did a cover on the Hustler, not a cover, but with a title article, The Larry McDonald Pie. There's no use to put those names on the air, but you may want to send for the article. I have reprints of it. It was in February 84. It came out in Hustler. But these people are all around death. They're trained killers. They brag about teaching to kill. They kill people that talk too much. And what if Larry McDonald would have to testify in California? Well, Liddy talks about wanting to kill somebody who testified. So it isn't far off with the technology we have to combine choosing a night for that flight or that meeting in South Korea. When Larry McDonald went alone, he, as I say, worked in the Korean War. He was a soldier there. And I'm sure that he could be told by the pilot, this is for top secret things. We're going to go over the Sakhalin area and we'll spy on them. I'll show you how we'll do it with a civilian plane and we'll get out. And in fact, the pilot of the former president of South Korea, or the current president, was the pilot on this plane. And he's sitting back there with Larry McDonald. And bang, there's an explosion. And they go. And they can blame the Soviet Union, unload Larry McDonald. And that's exactly what happened, and I haven't any doubt about combining the two, or the excuse being to get them out there, that they could do that that evening that would be safe in a civilian plane. Now, to something very serious that is going on, there are a lot of things I wanted to talk about this evening, but one that is really serious, and that's Mr. Gorbachev's questioning the summit. It was in the paper this morning, Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev has accused the United States of aggravating Soviet-U.S. relations and questioned the need for a summit meeting unless the trend is reversed. He said in Time magazine that the Soviet Union places immense importance on this meeting and that Washington appears to be preparing for confrontation rather than negotiation in Geneva, and it looks as if the stage is being set for a bout between some kind of political super gladiators, Rambo on our side, with the only thought in mind now on how best to deal a deft blow at the opponent. And he thought it was unfair for the world to think that the summit had any substance, that if they went there, the nations and people would hope for peace and a secure and tranquil life, and it's not going to go about this way. And he's absolutely right. If he's a man of any intelligence or integrity, he would call it off right now and stay home. The people of the world already know what Reagan is doing. It would just be a tragedy to try to meet with such snakes around every corner. Just look at the news just in the last few days, and how can you want to get together? As I say, there's a story that the decision to test the anti-satellite weapons comes out of the White House. Instead of the White House saying, don't do anything till after the peace conference, like Eisenhower said to the Pentagon, and the CIA, don't do any spy work until after I meet with Mr. Khrushchev in 1959. Let's see what we have in common before we do all this. They flew the plane that was downed and called off the meeting. The Pentagon was running it then. Now the president is stepping in also. Roland Evans and Robert Novak had a column this past week, August the 18th. John Lehman, 42, who in 4 years as Secretary of the Navy has built up a new U.S. fleet, wants to move up as a Secretary of Defense and take Caspar Weinberger's place. Although that would seem a tall order for the youthful cousin of the late Princess Grace of Monaco, high officials believe it may be within his reach, and they go back to the fact that John Lehman wants to be Secretary of the Navy. Now, Washington Times has a large full-page story this past week on Mr. Lehman. They're pushing him in all the newspapers. August the 20th, it was Lehman Power, the Navy Secretary's hard sell for the seas. And they're pushing him as a person of prominence, of distinction. He's been spending part of that $22 million an hour is going to John Lehman for his ships. In the article pushing John Lehman with his full page in the center of the page of the photograph, it says, few people can name the other two service secretaries, but they all know Lehman, the secretaries of the Navy. Well, I thought of two very quickly. One was Fred Korth, Secretary of the Navy, who went down to Texas at the time. He was involved with scandals with the General Dynamics, the TFX, and the F-116. And the attorney for Fred Korth was a man by the name of Mr. Ekdahl. And he's the same attorney Marguerite Oswald's husband used when she divorced him. Ekdahl represented her husband and Fred Korth. It was the same law office. Another Secretary of the Navy I remember is John Conley, who was Secretary of the Navy when Lee Harvey Oswald was in the Marines, and he was part of that Centro Comercial Mondrial, the Permandex operation. He's described in the Torbett books and in Paris Lamont's book, The Kennedy Conspiracy. He had a large role in the assassination of John Kennedy, even though by a fluke he was shot. They knew they had good marksmen. He did get bullets in him, but he survived. And John Conley and Fred Korth, both secretaries of the Navy from Texas, and I remember them very well. But I don't know how many of you heard John Layman on Nightline. It was about a year ago, and I have to send for that script. I'm sure they still have it. How he's going to attack the Soviet Union from the North Arctic, and his strategy of doing this to start the offensive war for World War III. Now, he wants to be Secretary of Defense. Mr. Gorbachev is saying, what's the use of coming? In the very week that he's questioning it, Layman is getting all this publicity. The San Francisco Examiner has two half pages of the newspaper, full sheets, Navy basing war strategy on costly subs. That was Sunday, August the 18th. These tremendously expensive submarines that he's building, each one cost $223 million, and extra parts are $113 million. Well, they're more than that. There's one of the attack class at $700 million. They go into there's several ships he's building for $1 billion each, he was explaining on television, that he'll have a fleet of submarines, $1 billion each, and even more than that. So we're talking about a peace talk, and in the newspaper we're talking about striking war with Russia. The San Jose Mercury and your newspapers, I'm sure wherever you live, have had articles like this. U.S. allegations, space weapon test, jeopardize relations, the Soviet Union said. Then Stansfield Turner, the former director of the CIA, put down that report of the powder. And only the New York Times put the denial. The other papers had the front headlines and that this chemical was such a danger. And it makes a lot of attention, but there's no proof that the Soviets went in and put it on those things. And as I say, the Los Angeles Police Department had an interview, an article in the Los Angeles Herald Examiner this week, August the 20th. And the LAPD says, well, we beat them to the chemicals. We've been using tracking chemical agents for a long time. It's a scheduled practice among U.S. law enforcement. And when a person touches a particular object, it indicates that he is a criminal. He's not supposed to touch that thing. And they follow him, and these tracking agents are applied. This dust is applied to money and undercover operations, and the chemicals invisible to the naked eye. The headline is FBI, LAPD beat the KGB to the punch on using this dust. Again, the use of this dust was going to be used by G. Gordon Liddy to put on the steering wheel of Jack Anderson. There's an article, April 14th, 1980. G. Gordon Liddy tells his side of Watergate and how he was going to try and get rid of Jack Anderson by putting powder on the steering wheel, and Anderson was wearing gloves. He evidently got wind of what was happening, and they were out to get him because of an article he wrote about an overseas agent, somebody in the agency was overseas. So he was out to get him. And G. Gordon Liddy used this powder a lot. G. Gordon Liddy works with John Singlaub, who's on Western Goals. And G. Gordon Liddy is part of the Soldier Fortune magazine, as I say. He's prominent. His picture is there. And so Larry McDonald's gang from the Western Goals and the Singlaub, Robert Brown group with Liddy are already familiar with the powder. The FBI uses it and the LAPD uses it. And as I say, Liddy bragged about how he was going to kill Howard Hunt and murder him and drug Daniel Ellsberg, so it's not separate from their lives. Now, going one step further to the Kennedy assassination, because that always interests people, and the use of disinformation, because, see, this is the way the war will begin. This war of strategy hasn't had so much to do with what the Soviet Union's been doing, but what we say they are doing and the way we write about them and the way we cover these headlines. Time magazine had a thing on the spy dust, and Newsweek, and every evening television begins with it. And then when it turns out to be not so and not fatal and not unusual and maybe not even happening, you don't see any more of it. They never retract. They go on to the next story. And it's that disinformation that Mr. Gorbachev I think he realizes that when it's there, there's no way to fight it. It's so powerful. Now, two very good researchers and very good friends of mine sent me some material which is apropos of this kind of disinformation, and they took one article from Variety magazine and laid it against a book, and I want to explain what it is, because, as I say, this is the way we're building up World War III, so these little lies, and testing these things instead of stopping the satellite test until we get together, or stopping nuclear weapons improvements, or making them until for 6 months moratorium. This president wants war, and he's been with the people who want war. That's why he's there. So he's doing everything to break it up, and there's no point in pretending that there's going to be anything to come out of this group. Now, in 1941, a book came out. It was called Out of the Night. I don't know how many of you remember that particular book, Out of the Night. Out of Variety magazine in 1983, there was a play that opened off Broadway, and this is what Variety said. The George Street Playhouse is presenting a drama in two acts adapted by Eric Krebs, K-R-E-B-S, from a book by Jean Valjean, staged by Krebs. He was in charge of the production. Out of the Night is an era dramatization of a 1941 autobiographical book of a disillusioned German-born communist who broke with the party, refused to help his wife and child. The Playhouse in New York had it. They said the adapter, Eric Krebs, is content to relate the story by monologues by the hero, a communist seaman whose sincere revolutionary zeal is locked up in the rigidity of his communist superiors in pre-World War II years, and this includes his disillusionment with the Communist Party. And Out of the Night was a very important book. I remember in 1941 when it came out, and I was going to Stanford, and these were the years when the Nazis were the bad guys, the Russians were fighting to survive, and now comes a book by Jean Valjean, telling about how bad communism is, how they deceit you, how they won't save your lives. And this was the book put out by Book of the Month Club. It was on the coffee tables. I had the book for years. I have to admit it. I'm going to have to get a new one at a book sale. But I had Jean Valjean's book, Out of the Night. And in 1983, 2 years ago, that book was being adapted by Eric Krebs for an off-Broadway play. Now, these friends went to the book, The Great Conspiracy, written by Michael Sayers and Albert Kahn, published by Little Brown in 1946 in Boston. And the book tells about the Dies Committee that was set up to look into communists in the United States. Nazis weren't problems. People on the head of the Dies Committee were known communists, were known fascist Nazis, and it goes into the investigators who were Nazis. In fact, one of them was a Nazi who later was put into the OSS. And in the process of firing one investigator, Mr. Sullivan, because he was a known Nazi, Hitler lover, Mr. Dies brought on Mr. Matthews, and he also was a known Nazi. And in an article about, in chapter in this book, bringing out the point of looking for the communists and the labor leaders and using these Nazis as your primary witnesses, they mentioned the kind of people that were testifying at the committee. And they said Richard Krebs testified before the Dies Committee in Washington. His alias is Jean Valjean, the same man who was supposed to have written the book. So in New York, the director of the play is the one who wrote the book, and he acts like he's directing, in 1983, a book written by Jean Valjean, but they're actually the same person. And in this Great Conspiracy, they say he was an ex-convict and a confessed former Gestapo agent, as if there's a former. But then there's a little footnote, and I want to read that to you, about Jean Valjean, the author of that book, and Mr. Krebs, who the same people, and how they work in the system, how he works in the system, the way that our anti-Russian literature is working now and every single day in the newspapers since the Russian Revolution, but it's really escalating fearfully under Ronald Reagan. And the footnote says, in January 1941, when the German High Command was completing their preparations and getting ready to attack the Soviet Union, a sensational anti-Soviet book was published in the United States entitled Out of the Night. The author's name was given as Jean Valjean. It was one of the aliases of Richard Krebs, a Gestapo agent, and it lists his other aliases. There were five, like E. Howard Hunt wrote books under all these different names. Krebs' book, Out of the Night, purported to be the confession of a communist, Jean Valjean, who was traveling out sinister assignments for Moscow, and the author related the experiences of his lurid work with Bolshevik agents and so forth. He told after 10 years of criminal service for the Soviet Union, the Comintern, an attempted murder in California in 1926 that he was supposed to do, and that then he got doubts about the Communist Party. It turns out later that Krebs Valtan served time in San Quentin for the charge of attempted murder, and the novel he was writing that the Communists did is what he did as a Gestapo agent. Is that finally, in the book, he has to make a break for Moscow and tells it all. Krebs arrived in the United States in February 1938 as a Gestapo agent. He brought with him from Europe the manuscript Out of the Night that had a startling resemblance to anti-Soviet propaganda book currently circulating in Nazi Germany. In preparing the book for publication in the United States, Krebs was assisted by the American journalist Isaac Don Levine, a veteran anti-Soviet propagandist and a contributor to the Hearst Press. Now, I'll go back to the Great Conspiracy in a minute, but Isaac Don Levine was helping a member of the Gestapo who had been in San Quentin on a murder charge and was deported, then arrived back in the United States in 1938, to continue his Nazi work. Now, incidentally, in 1938, is the time when Henry Kissinger's family was brought from Germany to the United States, the identical year that Mr. Valtan Krebs was brought to the United States again, was the year that Kissinger and his family, his brother was with him. His brother is very powerful at Princeton University, I understand. You never hear much about him. So 38 is a year where the Gestapo does, in fact, place people here from Germany. And I don't have time probably this evening, but next week I want to talk about Ronald Reagan as an informant for the FBI, because Kissinger came here in 38, Fritz Kramer came here in 39. In 1940, Reagan was co-starring with Errol Flynn. And 1941, he was an informer for the FBI, and in 1942, he was starring with Flynn again. And Flynn was working with Dr. Urban, who was naturalized in San Francisco, part of the spy network that Valtan Krebs worked with, and also Rudolf Hess, and setting up their headquarters. There is a common denominator among all these people. But I'll stop right now with the Isaac Don Levine part of this saga. I'll get back to it because I just want to mention that Isaac Don Levine was a fellow who worked with Marina Oswald. I described him in my first published article in The Realist in 1972. Many of you remember, this is why these friends found this, and they found it and sent it to me. I said in 1972 that Isaac Don Levine was the man who took Whitaker Chambers by the arm. He was reluctant to testify against Alger Hiss and reinforced him. And this is written up in the book Friendship and Fratricide by Dr. Zeldes. And Levine was an anti-Soviet agent at the time of Alger Hiss. Then, when Marina Oswald was widowed and Lee was killed, he immediately came in to work with Marina Oswald to make a Soviet plot out of the Kennedy assassination. And in 1972, I wrote about that in regards of Watergate and Nixon and the Nazis, and I cited John J. McCloy in the minutes of the Warren Commission in January. This is the first month. They're just starting to hear testimony from the witnesses. They're actually just starting, I think, in February. And McCloy is saying to the members of the commission, this fellow Levine is in contact with Marina to break the story up a little more graphic and tie it into Russian business. And with all that, the thought and background of a Russian connection, a conspiracy concept. Now, Isaac Don Levine was working in 1938, helping Mr. Krebs, Mr. Jean Valtan, bring out anti-Russian information so that we would not be antagonistic to Adolf Hitler. And he was a member of the Gestapo, like Dr. Urban was, who was working with Errol Flynn, and Flynn was co-starring with Reagan about this time. So Isaac Levine worked with Marina Oswald at that time. Then in the Rebel article in 1983, I cited the influence of Isaac Don Levine in at the time the Warren Commission was working. They hadn't finished their investigation. It wasn't over till September. And Isaac Don Levine was working with the Warren Commission to bring back to Argentine the daughters of the Zeigers who ran the Minsk radio factory in Minsk, Russia. Now, that is very important because of the links to the U-2 flight. And the point being that what was going on here was the opportunity to break up the Entente, the peace that could happen if the Soviet Union met with the United States, if the heads of states could meet, possibly they could have some peace. Now, I don't say necessarily they would, but possibly they would have some peace. And Isaac Levine worked, as I say, with Alger Hiss, who then makes Richard Nixon famous. You see, it was Levine who brought Nixon in the investigation of Alger Hiss to the prominence that he became vice president under Eisenhower. And when Nixon ran against John Kennedy in 1960, he lost. And by killing John Kennedy and making it a communist conspiracy at the same time, they bring in, again, Isaac Levine with the Zeiger family that brought down the U-2. That broke up the Entente at that time. So he's instrumental in affecting history more than once during the war, wanting us to be pro-Hitler. During the Cold War, escalating Richard Nixon, who then goes on to become president after Kennedy shot. During the Kennedy assassination, by twisting a communist conspiracy out of what Marina can tell from the Minsk white Russians, the CIA people. And then after Kennedy's killed, moving those people to Argentina who were involved at the radio factory. Now, what went on at the radio factory broke up the peace talks in 1959. Entente was dead because the U-2 was down. And once again, we're now breaking up our peace possibilities with all these other lies and propaganda that are going on continuously in the news about the Soviet Union purposely trying the satellite, which will antagonize them, just as we threw the U-2 spy plane over the Soviet Union to force them to back down, which is what we want them to do now, and Mr. Gorbachev seems willing to do that. But this role of Levine has covered this whole span of history. I'll continue with a little bit more. I hope I can finish this thing about Jean Valjean, the book, Out of the Night. The author was Jean Valjean. That's an alias for Richard Krebs. And not only was Isaac Don Levine helping him, but then book, Great Conspiracies, is aided by an unprecedented promotional campaign. Out of the Night was a sensational bestseller, the Book of the Month Club, distributed by Reader's Digest, and of course they have a long history with their intelligence operations. In two consecutive issues of Life magazine, they quoted extensive sections of the book. Few books in the history of American publishing received such promotional value. Now, Life magazine was the one that took the picture of Lee Harvey Oswald's head and put it on a body that wasn't his body in the backyard of Neely Street holding the rifle. Life magazine is the magazine that took the Zapruder frames and turned them around in juxtaposition so that there was no clear realization by looking at the stills of the direction of Kennedy's head going backwards. And Life magazine with Henry Luce was instrumental in pushing this story of Jean Valjean, the lie about the Soviet Union, so that we'd be pro-Nazi. And they also were the magazine that had the front page cover story of the Oswald diary that didn't exist. And Claire Luce is one of the biggest, the widow of Henry Luce, is one of the biggest funders as a member of the Knights of Malta on Ronald Reagan's House Intelligence Advisory Board, running the action to the Contras in South America to put in a slave state in those countries and wipe out the native populations on the basis that the Soviet Union is spreading. So these people weave from the pro-Hitler in the early years and the lies to affecting our State Department policy, to printing books, to printing lies and documents. But to go on just a little bit about this book, it tells about how popular the book was. It was reviewed in the Saturday Review of Literature. And then it goes on to say, oh, and another person that pushed the book was Eugene Lyons. Now, Eugene Lyons is a publisher for the Catholic magazines, close to Patrick Frawley in California, who called in Mr. Salvatore and the men around so-called kitchen cabinet that made Ronald Reagan president. So there isn't a small space between the Gestapo relationship of Jean Beltran and people like Max Eastman and Eugene Lyons and the anti-Soviet people working with a Gestapo agent. Now, the article, that's not an article, a great conspiracy book. I keep wanting to say the article. Great Conspiracy, I'm quoting, by Michael Sayers and Albert Kahn. Jean Beltran was a national figure. He was invited to testify before the Dyes Committee on March 28, 1941. He was served with a warrant and arrest as being an undesirable person and a deport. He was deported as an alien. The subsequent federal hearings established that Krebs was guilty of attempted murder in 1926 in California. He went to San Quentin for months, and what he was writing about was a book as saying the communists did it, as regarding the person he tried to kill. His excuse was, the Jew made me mad. That's why I had to serve time in San Quentin. But he was able to go in and out of the United States. He was deported after his San Quentin time in 1929 and re-entered the United States in 1938. And keep in mind that Taylor Caldwell was on the Board of Immigration from 1924 to 31, so she would have been there when he was deported. And goodness knows what the paper said, because he was coming right back to the United States where he could do his damage after the murder charges. And he served time in San Quentin. He goes to Germany, comes back with his book, is just as much part of the Gestapo, and is able to come in a time in 38, the same year as the Kissingers, and write a book about the communists telling him to kill a man where he was actually killing a Jew. He makes it out that the communists wanted him to kill this person, and that's the way history is written. But our hour is up. I want to do a little more about this next week, and I'll continue from here. I didn't finish all I wanted to say about him. But we'll have to put that off. Take care, and I'll be back with you next week. This is Mae Brussel, and, well, maybe I have another hour. No, I don't. Bye-bye.